Okay, today is Wednesday, January 5th, and we are here at the JCC in Houston, Texas, for our weekly Lunch and Learn. And we are talking today about a very interesting topic about God punishing the innocent. Should not too innocent, excuse me. It should be God punishing the innocent with the wicked. Okay? Everyone has a source sheet in front of them. Also, you could follow the source sheets here on the screen. Those of you at home, I hope you could see it on the screen. And I hope you could see the people who are in the room. Could you see the people?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Oh, yeah, here it is. Let me...
No.
Spotlight. Okay. Hopefully people on the screen could see the people in the room. Okay, let's get started. So our starting point is a verse in the Torah reading, in the biblical reading for this week, from the book of Exodus, chapter 12, Parshat Bo, it's called. It actually records the last three plagues that God brings on Pharaoh before he finally agrees or is forced to free the Israelites. And what we'll pick up the text where Moshe is telling the Jewish people that when it comes time for the last plague, you need to stay inside, right? The last plague is the plague of the slaying of the firstborn. And Moshe gives a warning to the Jewish people that they should stay inside. And I'll read the warning for you. It's from chapter 12. Starting with verse 21, you have it source number one on the screen and in your handbook. Vayikra Moshe l'chol ziknei Yisrael vayomer aleihem mishchu kechulachem son mishpachotechem v'shachatu ha-pasach. This is the requirement, the commandment for the Paschal sacrifice. And then you should take it and put the blood on the doorpost. And then in verse 23, which is the verse we're focused on, Va'avar Hashem lingof et Mitzrayim, God, for when God goes through to smite the Egyptians, V'ra'a et Adam al Hamashkof, V'al Shtei HaMezuzot, God will see the blood on the lintel and the two doorposts, U'pasach Hashem al HaPetach, God will pass over, right? Hence the name of the holiday, Passover. God will pass over your doorway. Velo yitein hamashchit lavo el batechem lingof. And not let the destroyer enter and smite your home. Okay? So this is interesting. And then also elsewhere, in chapter 12, at the end of the previous verse, it says, "Lo teitzu ish mipetach beito ad boker." None of you shall go outside the door of his house until morning. So stay inside. Why should you stay inside? What seems to be the meaning here? Why is it important for the Israelites to stay inside?
That God will not kill also the Jewish people.
The blood is protecting them from what? Right? And so presumably if they go outside, they run the risk of being destroyed by the destroyer, the mashchit. Right? Very interesting, right? They have to stay inside because if they don't, they'll be destroyed. So this may raise a question, which is, right. And what do they do wrong? Just because it's God who presumably can discern between who is innocent and who is guilty. So why was it forbidden for a Jewish person that fateful night to sort of take a little walk to just outside their house or to sit outside their house and enjoy the cool Egyptian air in the spring, I guess? Right, and the upshot of the verses is well, if you do go outside, you're going to be killed. Well, that raises a question. Why would the innocent be taken along with the guilty? Or the, at least, forget the guilty, the targeted audience of this plague was the Egyptian firstborn. Why would any Israelite, why would any Jewish person be taken, be in danger? Okay? I will enlarge the print to Betsy. Yes. Killed. Oh, the firstborn Egyptian. Egyptian, that was the last of the 10 plagues, the firstborn Egyptian. Two things. You had to have the mark on your door, which somehow signaled to God, this is a Jewish household, leave them alone. And on top of that, don't go outside. Right. That's the question we're trying to answer. That's exactly the question we're raising. So you're exactly where we need to be. You understand the question. Yes, yes. Ah, excellent. Said a little tongue in cheek, but good point. The question on the floor is maybe God subcontracted this plague, meaning it wasn't going to be God himself. It was going to be, and if you look in verse number 23, right? Verse number 23, it says the destroyer. Maybe that's not God. Maybe that's some angel of death that God hires. And maybe that angel of death doesn't have the wisdom to know who's guilty, who's innocent. But nonetheless, even though it's a plausible answer, it still does not, in my opinion, totally answer the question in the sense that why would God then send a messenger? We could just expand the question. Why would God send a messenger who can't do the job properly? That seems, it still seems to be unfair that the innocent is going to be taken with the guilty. So I'll take your comment, Ron, and then we're going to move on. I also run everyone on. I have a hard stop at 1 o'clock today, even though we started 15 minutes late, just because it's a little bit of a crazy day. Yes, Ron.
I've always thought that in the part, I was slaughtered.
Yes, good, excellent. Excellent. Right, excellent. Thank you. Thank you, Ron. So if you, that brings us to another question, which is this notion that we read about in the Haggadah at the Passover Seder, that God, right, that I am going to pass through the land and I am going to destroy, which means God did not subcontract this job out. So we're stuck. So let's try to find some answers. Excellent point, Ryan. Everyone is very on the ball today. Okay, here we go. Here's one answer by Rashi. It's short. Let's see if we can unpack what it means. Okay, it's the source here, source number 2 on the screen. Rashi says as follows. None of you shall go out. Right, Rashi is commenting on our verse. If remember, we've discussed Rashi before. He's a very important 11th century commentary on the Bible. He says, Magid, this tells us that when once permission is given to the destroying angel to wound, he makes no distinction between righteous and wicked. And nighttime is the domain of the destroying agencies, as it is said, thou makest darkness and it is night, wherein all the beasts of the forest creep forth. I don't want to pay too much attention to the second part about the nighttime being dangerous. I want to focus more on that first statement. This tells us that the destroying angel, that once permission is given to the destroying angel, which again bolsters the idea that this was contracted out, but then raises the question from elsewhere in the Bible where it says that God did this. We're going to get back to that. But permission is given to wound, no distinction is made. What do you think Rashi's trying to tell us here? It's quick, but I think he's making a broad point. We'll see the point more explicitly later. Betsy, you have something to say? Go ahead, unmute yourself.
I just said evil happens.
Exactly.
indiscriminately. I mean, you know, all the things that randomly happen to innocent people.
Yes.
It's just so
Betsy's raising a very good point, which is really an important theological idea. Stuff happens. And it doesn't necessarily distinguish between the wicked and the righteous, which I think it's a comforting point in general, but not a great answer to our question. It's a comforting point in general, which means, which I think what Rashi is saying, is the world works according to certain patterns, weather patterns, for example, or traffic patterns, right? The world works according to certain patterns. And when there's a car accident, most of us do not enjoy the level of divine providence that protects us personally. When there's a car accident, it's rare that God will say, I'm going to pluck this person out of danger, even though otherwise they should die because of the car accident. That's according to Rashi, that does not seem to be the way the world works, right? When the destroying angel, meaning when bad stuff is going to happen in the world and God allows bad stuff to happen in the world, sometimes the innocent get caught up in it. Well, that's a different point, that they're not suffering because of the bad, right? Although maybe you could argue if it was a drunk driver, they were. But let's say this was a no-fault situation. Yes, sometimes the good suffer along with the bad because we individuals do not enjoy this very high level of personal divine protection, right? We're all part of the world and we all play by the rules for better or for worse. The upshot is when the world is healthier and better, an evil person may benefit from that as well. But when the world is not working so well, a righteous person may unfortunately suffer. It could be that that's the broader point that Rashi's trying to make. The problem is, I see the questions in a second. The problem is that elsewhere, that here and elsewhere, we have explicitly saying that this is God actually stepping in. This is not the normal way, right? The normal way of the world is not to have just the firstborn be slaughtered. So we're already in a situation where the world is not working according to its regular order. So why would not God just add another element to that and save the innocent, which would remove the necessity to tell the Jewish people, don't leave your house? So Rashi does bring up a broad point, which I think is important. Doesn't fully, for me, help here. Okay, Carol.
So I was going to say this sort of fits in with the theology that God set the world in motion, and that once he set it in motion, he doesn't try and violate the rules that he established. But correct. I was going to ask.
Let's hold on 1 second, Carol, before you ask. Yeah. That is a fundamental and important position taken not only here by Rashi, but taken by other of the medieval commentaries, Maimonides, Nachmanides, that God's MO is to limit the miracles. God only goes into his miracle, his Mary Poppins handbag, right, when absolutely necessary. Otherwise, he doesn't, God doesn't. And this certainly plays right into that. Although here he's already in the Mary Poppins handbag, so why not just take, once he's got his hand in there, why not just take out a second trick to save the innocent? But again, Rashi's making a broader point. Now go ahead, Carol.
Well, I was going to say, the other thing that I'm struggling with is, so the destroyer knows to only kill the firstborn Egyptians, but he can't make a distinction between Egyptians and Jews?
Right. That's
it's a little weird. Yeah.
It is a weird. You're right. There's an inconsistency here. I agree, and I don't have a good answer to it. Okay. Yes, Ron.
I've always taken it that number one, Hashem did not want the Jewish people to see really what was going on in the school. And two, he wanted the Jewish people to be a little naive for what and in all this glory.
Okay, so Ron is suggesting that the reason why the Israelites were told not to leave was so they would not witness this miracle, and they would not witness maybe the downfall of their enemy. It could be, but the verse tells us that the verse gives us a reason, right? And not let the destroyer enter and smite. Well, that's really the reason for putting the blood on the doorpost. So it could be that they don't want to go outside just so that they don't see it. That's a possible read. We're looking at it from a different perspective, but that's possible. Now, to make matters a little more complicated, let's look at this midrash, which you find in source number 4, right here on the screen. This midrash, this rabbinic teaching on the Bible, is based on a verse in Numbers, which you don't have in your screen, but I'm going to read for you, which says, he's really focusing on this verse in Nahum. The Lord is good, a shelter in the day of trouble. So this verse, the Lord is good, a shelter in the day of trouble, you could understand might be viewed as contradictory to what's going on here. Right? We have a day of trouble, the plague of the firstborn, and God is not a shelter. Because if you're outside, or if you don't put the blood on your doorpost, someone's going to get you. So what does it mean? So here, listen to what the Midrash says here. We have to try to make sense then of this. The Midrash says as follows. The nature of the Holy One is unlike the nature of flesh and blood. In the case of a king of flesh and blood, we're right over here where the arrow is. In the case of a king of flesh and blood, when a province rebels against him, he acts against it with an indiscriminate punishment and kills the good along with the bad without considering. What do we call that in modern military terminology? Collateral damage. Collateral damage. That's a human being, but not God, right? Because God has the most advanced weaponry system. And God could just target this precise people who need to be targeted. This one has sinned and this one has not sinned. Instead, he kills the whole of it. Now, the Holy One is not like that. Rather, when a generation provokes him, he saves the righteous and destroys the wicked. The generation of Enosh sinned. He destroyed them, but rescued, where am I? Chanoch. And Chanoch walked with God. Why? The Lord is good, a shelter in the day of trouble. He knows those who trust in him. So God protects the innocent. The generation of the flood provoked him, so he destroyed them, as it said, and he blotted out all existence. But he rescued Noah, as it said, and Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. And similarly, with the Sodomites, he destroyed them, as it stated. Then the Lord rained down upon Sodom, but he rescued Lot, as it stated, and he sent Lot away. He brought darkness upon the Egyptians, but all the children of Israel had light in their dwellings. Why? The Lord is good, a shelter in the day of trouble. He knows those who trust in him. They went forth from Egypt and came to the desert. There they committed the deed, the incident of the golden calf, except for the tribe of Levi, of Levi. Thus it is stated, so Moses stood up, etc. Meaning, more and more examples of this, of God only smiting the innocent, the wicked. So now we have a problem. We have Rashi, who's quoting the Talmud, that says, as when the destroyer is given permission to destroy, the innocent are taken along with the guilty. And on the other hand, we have this midrash, which seems to be telling us exactly the opposite, that God protects the innocent, even when the guilty are going to be killed. Everyone get the question? So now we have two questions. One is, why are the innocent killed with the guilty? And the second question is, well, would the real God please stand up? Which one of these rabbinic teachings really reflects the way God operates? the one that we learned about regarding the firstborn, that sometimes the innocent gets swept away with the guilty, or the one that we read about regarding all of those other events in history where God protects the innocent. Which one is it? So anyone have a suggestion on how to solve this dilemma of the dueling rabbinic views of God? Okay. I see. Yeah, we got Ron.
Okay. The way I read it is Jim 1:22 was saying, you're innocent, but you're not really totally innocent.
Ah, okay. Ron's 3 for 3 today. Innocent, but maybe not so innocent. Meaning, so that's really interesting. Meaning, in a court of law, you're either guilty or you're not guilty. Or let me put it this way. You can't be a little pregnant, right? You're pregnant or you're not pregnant. But Ron is suggesting, well, you could be innocent, but not fully innocent, or guilty, but not fully guilty. That's interesting. Let's look at some sources that actually support what Ron is suggesting. Okay? Let's read on our source sheet. We're now on source number 5, which is on page number 3. This is the Talmud in Masechet Avodah Zarah. Difficulty that I just asked. Which is it? Or why is it that sometimes the innocent are taken with the guilty? And the Talmud in Avodah Zarah says, the Gemara raised the difficulty, but is it true that one who is completely righteous cannot be destroyed along with the wicked? Meaning we just read a whole set of examples from the second rabbinic text, right? That was text number 4, that seemed to say that the innocent are not killed with the guilty. Says the Talmud, but isn't it written in a prophecy about the destruction of the temple that God says to the destroyers, and begin at my sanctuary, meaning, now with this we have to use Hebrew, mimikdashi. And Rav Yosef teaches, do not read the word mimikdashi, but rather mimikudashai. Hebrew could be read differently depending on how it's vowelized. But you could hear the similarity in sound between the word mikdashi and mikudashai, which is God saying to the destroyer, when you destroy the temple, start with those who sanctified me, meaning the righteous. So what do you mean that God, that one who's completely righteous cannot be destroyed? We have another rabbinic teaching based on the reading in Ezekiel that says you can destroy, that the innocent are destroyed with the guilty. So the Talmud says, here we go. You ready, Ron? This is exactly what you said. But rather, I'm sorry, he explains. These are people who observe the Torah in its entirety, from the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet, Aleph, to its final letter, Tav. These people observe every mitzvah in the Torah, and yet they were destroyed along with the wicked. So how's that possible? There too, since they had the power to protest against the wicked and prevent them from sinning, and they did not protest, they are considered as righteous, who are not, Ron, completely righteous. So Ron nailed it. Right? There are people who we would look at as righteous, but it depends on the scale. It depends on who's counting. Who's the referee? And how much does the referee know about the person's life? They may seem completely righteous to us, but God knows. And what was the sin of these people? They were living in a generation where people were sinning. This is a whole nother interesting sort of teaching about our responsibility in the world. Meaning if we live, one teaching of this is if you live in a time and a place and a situation where people are doing something wrong and you don't protest, you're guilty. But that's not our topic. Our topic here is, one answer to this question is, yeah, if you're completely innocent, completely, completely innocent, you're not going to get swept away when something bad happens. But if you're not, you might be. That's an interesting question, right? It reminds me of the famous scene from Princess Bride. Have you all seen that movie, Princess Bride? He's not dead. He wasn't dead. He was mostly dead, right? You could be mostly dead, apparently, and you could be mostly righteous, but mostly righteous may not cut it. Now, that doesn't answer the question. Well, it may provide us an answer to both questions. One is, why are the righteous taken with the guilty? Well, now we know that righteous, there are different definitions of righteous. And basically, we don't know how God operates, and so we're just left with faith. Hold on one second. The other answer, and the second question is, which is the real one? The God who takes the guilty away with the righteous away with the guilty, or the one who doesn't? Well, now there's no contradiction between the two rabbinic teachings, because the one that says God protects the righteous, he's protecting the fully righteous. And the one that says God takes the innocent along with the guilty, those are not the fully guilty. I'm sorry, those are not the fully innocent, not the fully righteous, I should say. And so therefore, they're taken. That may provide some answer. Okay, let's see. We have 15 minutes left. Righteous. Yes, what's that? 100% righteous. That's a good question. So Ian wants to know, is anyone 100% righteous? I do not know the answer to that, but presumably God does. Right? And that goes back to the earlier question. Who amongst us gets to benefit from what's called hashkacha pratit, personal divine providence? Maimonides reserves that for only the most righteous. So this all comes together, right? Only the most righteous are plucked out of the pile up on the highway. Everyone else, unfortunately, you're in the wrong place in the wrong time, even though you're basically a good person. You didn't deserve to die. It's very interesting, two ways to look at it. One, some people will say, oh, there was a terrible plane crash. 200 people died. Everyone must have deserved to die. That's not necessarily the way Rashi looks at it. Back from the first comment he said, that may not be true. Sometimes bad things happen, and good people who don't deserve to die are caught up. That's just the way that God set up the world. It may not be, maybe it's comforting, maybe it's not. I think it depends on which way you look at it. Okay, let's look at a few more sources, a few more really interesting ideas. Rabbi Sadia Gaon, let's just read about him real quickly, then we'll go back. Rabbi Sadia Gaon, let me see, I'll find him on Wikipedia here. Important to know who we're talking about. Rabbi Sadia Gaon, if you see here, lived in the 9th century, 1882 or 1892 to 942. That period of time is called the Gaonic period, before the Middle Ages. It's called the Gaonic period. He was a Jewish philosopher, and he wrote a very, very important book we're going to read a snippet from, called Emunot V'Deot, Beliefs and Opinions. And he's wondering too, where? Good question. I think I want to say Egypt. Let's see. He was born in Egypt. Yeah, Egypt. Okay, so he is also troubled by this notion that the innocent sometimes suffer. And he says this, we are confronted, this source right here, source number 6. We are confronted by the fact that God, the just, ordered the killing of the young children of the Midianites and the extermination of the young children in the generation of the flood. So he, bless you, whoever sneezed, Gesundheit. He just raised an interesting question, similar to our question, which is, if you look at the generation of the flood, everybody was destroyed, even the babies. What did they do wrong? So again, one answer is, that's just, you know, that's the way it goes. What did the babies who died in 9/11 do? That's a bad example because that's a terrible example, actually. Scratch that from the record. Because nobody in 9/11 was guilty, I'm assuming. Scratch that from the record. But, you know, why did anybody die who's innocent? His answer is fascinating. He says, we note also how he continually causes pain and evil, death to little babes. Logical necessity therefore demands that there exists after death a state in which they would obtain compensation for the pain suffered prior thereto. This is really astounding. What is Rabbi Sadja Gaon saying? How does he deal with his theological problem of the innocent suffering? What does he do?
He gives him an out of a reward.
Right, right, Betsy.
Heavenly reward or right. Whatever.
Right, meaning the existence of the afterlife, which is a reward, excuses God from killing them as innocents or as children. I mean, it's impossible, says Rabbi Sadja Gaon. It's impossible. Right? He says logic necessitates. It's impossible that God would kill these people unless there was some reward for them on the other side. Otherwise, it would be unfair. But because there is a reward for them on the other side, it's fine. Now, you may or may not find that a satisfactory answer, right? But it's how he proves. Listen to what Rabbi Sadja Gaon is doing here. He's proving the existence of the afterlife based on this notion of the innocent suffering. Because a just God could not possibly cause the innocent to suffer unless there was an afterlife. So there must be an afterlife. I find that astonishing. Fair enough. So that you're not satisfied with this approach. You're not the only one. But it is in a really interesting approach. Okay, question, Ron.
My question here is, if Hashem knows the future of everything, which I really feel that he does, he knows what the future of these so-called innocent babies, whatever, and what kind of problems that they're going to cause when they're growing up.
Okay. Ron is suggesting that maybe these innocents are being killed because of what they're going to do when they grow up. That's for another time, although there is a lot of discussion on that, and I think the prevalent opinion is that God does not step in like that. God does not step in like that. And history may, in fact, show that. But that's a good question. Okay, a few more things. Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, contemporary scholar, passed away, let's see, when, what year did he die? Look him up real quick. He died in 2015. Okay, there you see his picture. He was the leader of a very important yeshiva in Israel called Har Etzion, born in Paris, died in Israel. He says he's also... He's talking autobiographically here. The source of my support was not confined to my immediate rabbis. He's talking about who supported his religious and spiritual growth. So in the essay that I'm quoting from, he talks about his teachers. And he says, it wasn't only my teachers who were living. It was also other historical figures who gave him a sense of his faith. At one point during my late teens, I was troubled by certain ethical questions concerning the destruction of Amalek, etc. It's another example where God tells the Jewish people to kill everybody in Amalek, the nation of Amalek, men, women, and children. So Rabbi Lichtenstein is troubled by that. Again, why should the innocent be killed? I then recalled having recently read that Rabbi Chaim Brisker, this is Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, would awaken nightly to see if someone hadn't placed a foundling at his doorstep. I knew that I slept quite soundly, and I concluded that if such a paragon of kindness coped with these laws, evidently the source of my anxiety did not lie in my greater sensitivity, but in my weaker faith, and I set myself to enhancing it. This is a beautiful story, but an incredibly high bar. He's saying, I had these doubts, these questions when I was a kid. And he says, however, there was a greater man than I am, Rabbi Chaim Brisker, who was so concerned with ethics that he would get up every night in the middle of the night to see if a mother hadn't abandoned their baby at his doorstep. I guess that happened from time to time. That's how ethically concerned Rabbi Chaim Brisker was. Despite Rabbi Chaim Brisker's high ethical sensitivity, he still maintained a high level of faith in God. And so Rabbi Lichtenstein says, well, if this man who was so plugged in ethically, because a proof is he looks out for abandoned babies, which I don't, and he could live with these questions, then I, who am less plugged in ethically, I could also live with those questions. And what should I do? He said, I should work on my faith. It's really, it's astonishing, right? Meaning there's a system. I believe in the system. I have some questions, but overall, my job is to work on my faith. And hopefully I will be able to overcome those questions. Maybe I will, maybe I won't. It's really, I think it sets a very high bar. But knowing about Rav Lichtenstein, and if you would read about him, it would not be a surprise that that is his approach. And I don't know if he ever, he said he was troubled when he was a teen. And in this essay, he says that he continues to seek answers, and he has found some answers. But this is a fascinating approach to this as well. Okay, 5 minutes left. Switching gears. We've looked at a troubling element of the way God lets the world operate, where the innocent are taken away with the guilty. We've come up with some answers. Maybe they're not completely innocent, not completely righteous. There's one approach that we've seen. We've seen an approach by Rabbi Sadia Gaon that says, yes, in fact, sometimes the innocent, in this case, children, are killed along with the guilty. That happens, but it's also a proof in the world to come. I mean, he's not denying it. Let's switch gears and look at him for a minute at the work of Rabbi Aaron Samuel Tamares. I'm not sure how to pronounce his last name, 1869 to 1931. This is a fascinating figure. He's a Jewish pacifist. Okay? You could look him up on you could Google him. Some of his stuff is available online. And he is looking at the verse that Ron questioned at the beginning, which is, as the text of the Passover Haggadah states, "And I shall pass through Egypt on this night. I am not an emissary." Meaning, again, he did not subcontract that, according to this verse. It's me. And when the verse, the very first verse that we studied, when it talks about the destroyer, it's God, according to this reading, right? So God's going to do it. Why? Why is God going to do it? So it says, the Holy and Blessed Be He could have given Israel the ability to exact revenge on the Egyptians themselves. Right? Why not? Like in the story of Purim, the Jews go out and defend themselves. Why here didn't God tell the Jews, the Israelites, okay, time to fight for yourselves. Don't stay inside. Don't be afraid of the destroyer. Go get them. Right, it's connected to our verse. It's not connected to our question, really. It's connected to our verse, but I couldn't help but sharing this with you. However, the Holy Prophet, he did not want to show them how to use their own fists. Remember, this man's a pacifist. Even though at that moment it would be to protect themselves from the wicked, it would end up causing the spread of the use of the fist throughout the world, and the defenders would eventually become pursuers. And then he turns to our question. This is really amazing. We can now explain the Braita that discusses the verse, "You shall not leave not anyone from the door of his home until the morning." Remember, we said that. That's the verse we started with. No one can go out. If you go out, you're going to get killed. He says that's not why God didn't want them to go out. God didn't want them to go out because he didn't want them to fight. Rav Yosef taught, once permission was given to the destroyer, he will not differentiate between wicked and righteous. This is amazing. Again, in our reading earlier, the destroyer is either God or God's emissary. Rabbi Tamaris's reading is, who's the destroyer? A human being. And once you give the human being the right to kill, even justifiably, what is that going to lead to by definition? Unjustifiable killing. It's incredible. Let's read it together. Once permission is given to the destroyer, he will not differentiate between wicked and righteous. At first glance, this bright is a deep contradiction to the statement in the Haggadah of I and not an emissary, which was our question. How can the bright to say once permission was given to the destroyer? Meaning, was it God or the destroyer? He has another answer. We said maybe destroyer means God, or we gave some other answers. But according to our ways, the two statements match. For the Brita is coming to explain why the Holy One sought to exact vengeance himself and did not allow the Israelites even to look. The answer is that God acted in this way so as not to arouse a destroyer that is within the Israelites themselves. For once permission is given, he will not distinguish between wicked and righteous. The defender will in the end become a pursuer. Power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. Meaning, this who is this talking about? This first verse down here, and not let the destroyer enter to smite your home, that's the Jewish people. Do not give the Jewish people permission to fight, because even though this would be a legitimate fight, eventually people get used to that, and the defender becomes a destroyer, and again, he's a pacifist and believes that is the Jewish way. So he eventually comes around to trying to answer one of the questions we have, which is, which is it? Was it God? Or someone else. He says, yeah, it was God, and the someone else that's being talked about is the Israelites, and they're the ones who are supposed to stay inside, because otherwise they will taste the use of their fist, and we can't have that. Okay, I have to stop here. I'm going to stop the recording. I'll take your question in a moment. I'm going to stop the recording. Say thank you to everyone for joining. I'm sorry it feels a little rushed, but I have a meeting that started a minute ago, so I'm going to have to run. Thank you for joining. I hope to see you next time. Shalom.
Shalom. Thank you, Rabbi.